Hey, we're checking in with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy during April school vacation week. Tacky, how are you?
Hey, Joe, good morning on Wacky Wednesday.
Indeed. We've had all kinds of weird weather. We had 50 mile an hour winds. We've had 82 degree temperatures. We've had snow in the past 5 days.
Yeah, it is typical New England, unable to decide what the weather should be and new ways to torture us, I suppose. And obviously, the pollen count is high. As some of you may hear, my voice is a little more craggly than normal.
Yes, it's allergy sufferers will sympathize with you, I am sure. Congress is off this week. Is the State House off this week too?
Well, unofficially off, right? I mean, obviously the offices are still open. The committee is getting ready for a hearing on Tuesday. We are viewing requests for budget amendments, co-sponsorships, because the budget is supposed to go in debate on Monday, waiting for official schedule on Friday. So yeah, we're off and we're not off. It's kind of this like quieter period where we're still working, but it's not as intense as it would be. Going into the budget, and actually, it will be quiet right immediately after the budget as well. Still continue to work, prepping the hearings, prepping the bill summaries, organizing meetings of various interests, plus constituent services continue to come in. A very broad range of constituent services right now coming in. There's still plenty of work to do. It's just not as insane it is this week because people are pretty quiet as they just going into the budget.
Right. I did notice that the latest unemployment figures were released earlier this week, ticking up slightly. Are you seeing that manifested in your constituents?
Yeah, unemployment calls are coming in. It's still fairly steady. It's not spiked a lot. Again, I represent about 45,000-ish constituencies in Quincy. If I get five, one a day or two, one a week or two a week, and that's pretty substantial when you weigh it against the size of my constituents. And Quincy numbers are generally very good at unemployment against the statewide number. So we'll see how this continues to play out as construction slows down in Boston because Mayor Wu has not been able to lure new development. And general consumer spending is going to go down, plus the impact at some point on tariffs and prices, plus wage inflation, plus still relatively high interest rates, although it's not high historically, but high in our recent memory, plus government contracts, namely the federal government contracts, terminating. And at some point, whether the federal employees that took the buyout eventually is going to come off the buyout money and have to apply for unemployment. Or those who are terminated, and are going to unemployment. So, Health and Human Services in Boston and EPA in Boston has had layoffs. Those won't be apparent for a little bit in our unemployment numbers. And also, the unemployment number is one of those things where you want to see a steady number. And the reason you want a steady percentage is because it means people coming on and off, meaning there's, continuous rotation of people getting a job, losing a job, getting a job. It's consistency. When it starts to tick up, it means the job market's getting weaker.
Right, people that can't find work, so they're on unemployment more and longer at the same time, right? And I'm curious too about how the drop in people in the family shelter system will impact unemployment as well.
The family shelter is actually kind of declining gradually over the last 5 months, 6 months or so. So it's people coming onto the employment rolls or have left the state to go somewhere else for employment. It means that our investment in lawyers to help them get work visas, again, these temporary workers to the Biden administration, I'm sorry, these temporary visas the Biden administration allowed did not include a work visa. We've been picking up the slack with a combination of local volunteer organizations, not-for-profits, and state ourselves and helping work on processing paperwork under the Trump administration, and given the shrinkage of government, which, I'm not against trimming some fat, but I mean it could slow down work permits depending on where they're trimming. It's very confusing what is going to be impacted in terms of response times. So, the shelter issue is coming down. The state budget reflects the number that we expect, around $350 million we're spending, which is fairly consistent in a unemployment rate that we're looking at now that's over 4%. So, we're following economic indicators in anticipation of what the shelter needs will be. And remind folks that given that people are unemployed, housing becomes a problem. So, the shelter system obviously isn't just people on emergency visas. There's a large portion of the population that is not on emergency visa. They're local residents or border residents who have, let's say, a domestic violence situation, seeking shelter. So, again, rotate as the economy rotates.
Right, yeah. And with the vacation time coming up, a lot of employers will be looking for some seasonal help too. And traditionally that did fall to foreign workers. We'll see where that stands this year.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of factors going on here. One, we've seen since COVID a challenge of bringing back foreign workers, especially seasonally, especially in the Berkshires and Cape Cod in particular. Most people would not realize when you go down to the Cape that you have a lot of foreign workers there on summer work visas. The hostile environment towards immigrants and temporary workers is not lost on foreigners. I think we talked about this last time, how people take this extremely personal, this tariff war, and people are no longer treating like politics as politics. Politicians are being themselves, and it's their problem. People are making it their own problem now, and that could discourage temporary work over the summer months if they feel they're not welcome and safe in the country.
Yeah. You know what we have not talked about in April, Jackie, yet is April is Asian American Pacific Islander Month. Isn't that right? AAPI month?
That's May.
Oh, that's May. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's May. We still
That's
got
why we
another.
haven't talked about it in April.
It's Earth Day. Earth Day was was this week on the 20th.
Yes.
And no, that's in May. That's coming up. So the Red Sox are actually going to kick off on May 2nd, AAPI month, at the Fenway, and then the Asian American Pacific Islander Commission will have their opening unity dinner that Saturday, the 3rd, I believe, May 3rd. So, I mean, my calendar is already lining up with speaking engagements through the month of May. Various organizations that want to hear from me. So, on top of doing things like Memorial Day, follow from the budget, because there's always going to be fallout from doing the budget, running public hearings. I do have that one added piece of work in May, is trying to get to groups to see me. And obviously, the Asian Caucus has 7 members, so we're able to get some of the work that spread around to more than one of us.
Yeah, very good. Are you hosting any student groups this school vacation week at the State House?
No, I'm a little surprised. We got some student group requests, but it's actually after school closes in June and July.
No.
And some, like we have an ESL class that comes in the summer. We do get some folks that come in March. They don't always tell me they're coming, so it's not a problem. I mean, I don't get slighted by that. But sometimes they do make their own plans. If they don't tell us, I'm like, cool. I mean, it's not a problem. And obviously, the delegation likes to have at least one of us available when a school comes to the State House. It doesn't matter which of us available, but one of us is available. But yeah, no, it's very quiet on that this week. I was hoping like scouts may come in or something like that during this week, and that didn't materialize. So, but when you get to the month of June, school buses galore along Beacon Street, where every 5th grade class, it seems like, comes to the State House.
Yeah, that's something we never did in 5th grade, but I guess it's been a more recent tradition, which is kind of nice actually. It's an impressionable age, so it's probably a good age to expose them to it.
Oh, I absolutely agree 100%. I didn't get to go to the State House in 5th grade either. I didn't realize that was a thing until I started working at the State House. And it's always, honestly, it's great to answer questions from the kids, tell them a couple fun stories about a building and some trivia, and also for them to learn and appreciate frankly, the ancient styles. I mean, the original part was built in 1797.
That's right. Yeah. And then you have the new section, right, in the 1800s.
Yeah, 1899 is the new part, so.
Only in Boston. So are we going to be taking part in any Quincy 400 events at the State House? Do you know, is the governor coming at some point this year or anything of that nature?
I've not been informed by the governor's office that coming to Quincy for any 400 anniversary events. Obviously, I encourage folks to look at the Quincy 400 anniversary website. The city has a number of events going on systematically, like every month, every 4 weeks, 3 weeks or so, ranging from concerts to displays. And the mayor, the council, DPW, Parks Department, police, I mean, they all do a wonderful job of putting things together here. And they get a lot, they do a great job of putting things together on the Adams Common too. It's been a wonderful space for them to host any kind of family event. So yeah, I mean, keep an eye out. There'll be more coming, and always will plug the Quincy Sun because the city will use that as their medium on providing the schedule.
Speaking of the Common, you probably heard Congressman Lynch is coming this Saturday to hold a rally in support of the working class, he says.
Yeah, I heard about that. I would probably try to make a trip down on Saturday to say some hellos. As you've all seen, there's been various types of protests all through the nation, whether it's anti Trump administration or promoting or supporting important causes to them that could be under threat. And it's a large variety, as you can imagine. It's a lot of activism still. But as I always say, nothing sends a message better than the ballot box, especially in states outside Massachusetts. I've talked about this before. Despite the administration talking about cuts across the government, I mean, certain Republicans, particularly in leadership down in Congress, try to save their own bacon regarding local services. So, people, cannot tell me that this is not a favoritism system. It is still largely driven by some degree of politics. So, I mean, the veiled threat that they discovered they couldn't do of selling the Boston federal buildings because they actually don't own the buildings. A lot of those buildings are owned by a real estate investment trust company. They have leases from the real estate investment trust company. Things that they were so ignorant they didn't realize. So they're making kind of statements out there without actually doing any homework just to get at people. And I've said this over and over again. I mean, I expected laser focus revenge, but I expected laser focus intelligently research revenge. And that is not what's going on. This is grossly inefficient. From my standpoint, I mean, obviously, you don't want me getting revenge because, as you can tell, I'm into doing homework and it ain't coming for you. But that's not the case with this administration. And, I said this before as well. I mean, the buckshot approach to everything, it's like things happen, then they try to take credit for it, then they throw 20 options at you, hoping you take a bite at one of them, that's the actual reason of doing it, not actually you accepting that it's all the reasons on the table, of which may be contradiction to each other.
Yeah, it's classic diversionary tactics, the military uses sometimes, actually.
It's very political, right? I mean, it's not oblivious to me and you and all the listeners that politicians do the sleight of hand, right? I mean, you and I have played this game more than once as I'm trying to wiggle my way out of a topic that you want to talk about as I'm trying to figure out what the answer is. And sometimes you catch me too where I don't actually have the answer because I've never looked into the matter to start with. So I get into like a bit of a squirmy position. It's kind of like, oh, this is uncomfortable. Joe just picked something. I have no idea what he's saying. But I mean, that's kind of the reality of how we run this show together, where, I really don't know what's going to happen. And, I'll get to that part where I'm like, okay, we got to see if I can play a sleight of hand with Joe to sh shift the topic. But this is special because I've never seen literally, like, I'll give you all these options. Half of them contradict each other, but we hope you won't think hard enough to notice.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's relying. It's relying on ignorance, and unfortunately, and it's a sad state of affairs, I think, when you can't be honest and upfront with people.
Well, I mean, let's talk a little bit as, historical facts, and let's ignore the Great Depression. I mean, Hoover was the president who was the last one that did an enormous type trade war of this style when he took on the planet, and he got his ass kicked. United States literally got its ass kicked, and the U.S. is still, again, during Herbert Hoover, the largest GDP country on the planet. Now, there's a Great Depression. There were two stock drops. There was a Dust Bowl. There was, the end of World War One. U.S. Exports to Europe because the European economy was rebuilt after World One, so obviously your exports declined to Europe. So, I mean, there was a lot of factors that drove the Great Depressions. One of the biggest reasons, overinvestment by normal people in the market, but that's not the sole reason. It's a lot of factors that hit simultaneously. But Herbert Hoover, decided in a kind of topsy-turvy economy, start a massive trade war with the planet and got his ass kicked. And so goes the U.S. economy, so go the planet. And it's been shown statistically time and time again, this when we go down, it tends to bring everyone down with us at some level. So no one shielded from it. So I mean, this is different. Obviously, the economy's strong still, as we talked about unemployment rate earlier, but also consumer spending is still continuing. I'm very concerned about the size of credit card debt. Credit card delinquency is going up. It's only 0.7% delinquency or in that zone. It's creeping up to 1%. And some of you think, 1% is not a big deal. Yeah, but we're talking about trillions of dollars in credit card debt. And generally the wrong end of the economic spectrum that ends up losing out. So a lot of folks that are middle class folks are more likely to go into debt on credit cards than upper income folks in particular. Car loans are being defaulted. And student loans, are default rates are rising too. So there is a lot of stress on folks regarding that. I mean, this isn't the 08 financial crisis. This is a very different economy, and I recognize that. But there's some reason that, a little detail, well, he likes to talk about President McKinley. It is President Hoover that engaged in a massive trade war at the wrong possible time. Is it the right possible time now? Perhaps. I mean, history doesn't repeat. I'm just pointing out the fact that, things have been done in the past before and doesn't always work out.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, the credit card issue, that's indicative of folks who are, relying on credit more and more for staples of everyday life, which, is not a healthy way to run your own finances.
Well, upper income folks, not the super wealthy, but just upper income is feeling stressed now. I mean, if you look at the big box stores, particularly Costco, BJ's, and others. Upper income folks are spending a lot more time in those stores than they have been in the past. So the pressure is on. So, well, the lower end of the economic ladder is feeling a lot of pressure when you're getting community consumer survey reports and big box stores reporting the upper end of the middle income scale is feeling pressure. That's generally, indicator that things are going to get considerably worse in consumer spending.
Yeah, and I also read not too long ago that those folks, the upper income, are more and more turning now to places like food pantries, for staples that they never had to before.
Yeah, I mean the pressure, everyone's feeling a bit of, well, everyone's feeling the pressure. I mean, there's just no way I can describe it. I mean, people are gonna be tightening, and there's been a bit of hoarding already. I mean, I was at BJ's a couple of weeks back, and I couldn't find Tide. They had like seven things of Tide left. A lot of detergent was missing at the crown call at BJ's. So, I mean, I don't know exactly where Tide is made, to be honest with you. But if you look at the import numbers in March, there was a large number of imports coming in globally to the U.S., especially China, on big box stores stockpiling. There's a report that Apple flew in $1 billion worth of iPhones from India right before the tariffs began. So, clearly the companies that can afford to, we're definitely stockpiling. And unfortunately, half our economy is driven by small business, and small businesses cannot stockpile. They are very much on a buy on demand based on their consumer history flows. So the reality is that box stores can probably last a little longer and trying to keep prices reasonable. But smaller businesses, again, which is half our economy, cannot. And we're talking about, half of $29, $30 trillion GDP. So we're talking about 15-ish, 14-ish trillion dollars in GDP that are small business driven. If they start to fall apart, I mean, the thing gets pretty bad overall. They're also our biggest employers. I mean, I know Stellantis has already laid off folks as a result of the car parts and car tariffs. But it's really when you start seeing stores shutter inside your hometowns, wherever you live listening, that's when things really get ugly at the local level regarding business and our economy. So, and then he also put on these enormous charges on Chinese-made ships coming over. So the California port, which is the most busy port in North America, taking the majority of shipments of China, has a 60% decline on cargo trade already within the last month. 60% decline in cargo trade because once they started charging the ships a higher fee to come to port, the ships can't be not 100% full. And Chinese companies and US companies bringing stuff from China because not every contrary to what he says, because it's very contradictory. So Chinese companies are killing us. Yeah, but there's also US companies in China too. It keeps the convenience of messaging depending who he's what he's saying that day. So it's both of them. But US company is thinking the same thing. They're not gonna bring over product, not a full ship.
No. And I mean, there's so much uncertainty as well. Just today or yesterday, there's hints that the Chinese tariffs may be rolled back or postponed again. So, business people don't really know what to do.
But Wall Street Journal reported and was confirmed by the White House that they're not going to do anything unilaterally. They're going to do something as part of a deal. And it's interesting that statement because he already did some unilateral stuff regarding certain electronics, especially not just Apple stuff, but also semiconductors and other precious metals that we need from China for our high-tech industry. So they say they're not going to do stuff unilaterally. They actually already did. And I'm not saying it's a right or wrong decision, but they say a lot of stuff, and it's weird because negotiation happens behind closed doors. A lot of rumors. Not sure if anything's correct, but they're doing a weird negotiation in public with the American people. And I don't know if you all realize that it's not negotiation when they come up and talk to the press, right? It's not negotiation with China. It's a negotiation with us. And they use the stock market, the bond market, the dividend trades, the commodity trades as their indicator on whether their messaging and negotiating with us is working. And they use their indicator not through polling, not through surveys. They do it through the bond market, stock market, commodity trade, all our major economic indicators, which are more immediate and short-term effects. So, for example, Trump actually never used the word he was going to fire Jerome Powell from the Fed Reserve. He said his termination couldn't come soon enough because they didn't know if they could terminate him. And Secretary of Treasury Bassett said they're researching whether they could terminate him or not. However, the market took a massive tumble over the weekend. The Asian markets and European markets followed suit. And then, Monday was a nightmare yet again, another 1,000-point shift in the Dow, which has happened far too many times now for people's tastes. And now there's been two major recoveries yesterday and this morning on the Dow because they said they weren't going to fire Jerome Powell. He's completely rescinded that position because it's very clear he's using not just the Dow Jones but all the different markets as indicators to determine negotiation with us, the public, on how we're going to respond to different statements and our tolerance level. And he's using that as their indicator. It's interesting observation because I've never seen any president do it this way. Normally you do massive polling.
Yeah, and it's I'm sure it's frustrating for a lot of people who are trying to, just plan their own personal finances and not really knowing what to do.
Well, I was talking to a couple of folks who are retired, they're in retirement savings and have watched their retirement savings completely devastated since they now had a plan in place regarding gradual drawdown. And for you to recover some of that money, you're probably going to have to pull back on your drawdown as at some point the market recovers and you get some of your money restored to previous levels. You cross your fingers anyway. And those who are nearing retirement, as we saw in the 2008 recession, postponed retirement. People working into their 70s, easily, because they had to. So, and kids, were not happening because people started postponing having children later, during that same time period because of fiscal uncertainty. Younger folks are looking at their pocketbook as part of family planning.
Does this also impact public pensions? I mean, is that something that folks are looking at too?
Yeah, every public and private pension in this in the country is impacted by the market, and they practice a very conservative and safe investment overall. Some of them were dumb, if I remember correctly. I think the Southern California pension system was heavily invested in Bernie Madoff. That was dumb. Clearly, well, Massachusetts had minimal, and I mean minimal, I mean decimal points level of exposure to Bernie Madoff. So, the pension fund, I want to say it's, God, I haven't looked at the number in a long time. I think it's over 80 billion. And you got a guy that's making like not even $400,000, I think, something like that, running a pension fund that size. To put it in perspective, people getting paid $20 million or so to run Harvard's pension fund at like $38 billion. So, as much as taxpayers, loathe government salaries, you got to remember that certain positions, such as managing our pension fund, is far cry when you're paying someone, in the 400, 450 zone, and other people making $20 million to manage a fund that's half the size. We have the same problem in the medical examiner's office. There's a lack of doctors. We cannot compete with the private sector on that. Same thing with engineers. We cannot compete with the private sector on that. So there are a number of professions, particularly on the higher skill and requiring experience. You just don't come out of medical school to the medical examiner's office. You have expectation you have practiced medicine for a while. So, I mean, there's obviously been a shift to the private sector with the low unemployment rate. For a lot of professionals. And I've seen this before. We saw this during the dot-com boom. Even state house employees were not staying one full year when I was there. I should have left myself, I suspect. But they were getting paid, 25, 30% more, working for a tech company. They just needed workers. So, this is not unnatural. It's very normal for government to lose the competition on best talent because we can't pay as much.
Yeah, we're seeing it at the municipal level. Also, I know in some communities, at least, they can't keep up.
Yeah, this is just a fact. We talked about things like residency requirements, and my response is always saying you want the best talent you could find, not the talent that's closest to you. And that's pretty hard. And this is a global problem where, if you don't have an incentive to come work in government, you're not going to stay. And, sadly, the pension system isn't as attractive as people think it is. I think it's a good attraction is how we keep UMass professors. UMass is the highest paid employees in the state, but tenured professors at UMass don't make as much as tenured professors at other, big schools in the region. But the pension system and a good healthcare program and a commitment to public service keeps them around.
Yeah, you mentioned Harvard. What do you make of the lawsuit that Harvard's got against the federal administration for federal grants?
I was talking to a friend about this the other day, because These are contractual agreements. They're not just handouts. And I think that's the way the Trump administration tried to portray grants. It's like, I'm just going to hand you money. The expectation is that you get the money, you apply for the money, you get the money, and then you're supposed to deliver something for said money. Now, whether that results in research that turns into a positive manner, well, you don't know till you start the research. But it, not allowing these grants to continue could set back a lot of things, decades in research, in all sciences in particular. And some stuff you never know, like, for example, Ozempic, diabetes, weight reduction, fat reduction drugs. Those drugs actually came from a research paper regarding, I think, iguanas from like the 70s regarding metabolism issues. Some strange study that someone dug up and realized that they're looking for some very specific chemical indicators that are actually similar in humans. So, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's all kinds of stupid studies.
Oh,
But the
sure.
problem is that you don't know, how these studies may affect future studies when they're trying to find new types of medicines or new types of engineering. A lot of ideas are built on someone else's ideas and then just keep building, 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 building. So, there's two folds here. One is, from a contractual standpoint, the federal government violated its contractual agreement with everyone who gets a grant, because it's not just Harvard and the big Ivy League schools. It's across the board. I mean, local nonprofits have seen some grants taken away or reduced that was committed to them, excuse me. And then you got this a situation where there could be a huge negative impact, not necessarily on unemployment levels, because obviously no grant, no job, but perhaps research in the sciences in particular that could set us back, 5, 10 years that were already in progress.
Massachusetts could be disproportionately affected just because of the high concentration of that field in this state, in the greater Boston area, particularly.
Yeah, I think up to $5 billion worth of biotech company grant monies were suspended. I don't know what the biotech companies are doing. They've not made the news on their next course of action. Again, these are global players, not just domestic players, because the nature of biotechnology and are one of our biggest economic drivers and one of our signatures and gems of being in Massachusetts. So. No, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, I think the public may think grant money is just kind of a handout. Those who fill out grant programs realize there's a contractual agreement once you've been awarded, because the grant requires you to do certain things and demonstrate you can do certain things, or you're attempting to do certain things, that you must show that you've done said things pursuant to the use of money.
Right, it's not carte blanche. I mean, we're speaking to today. This is Community Development Week all this week, and I know here in Quincy there are, different events planned to highlight how those federal grants are used to benefit the community, the people of Quincy, but that has to be documented. That has to be, demonstrated to the federal government if you want to get any more grants.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, I remember back in my younger days, I was at the old Atlantic Neighborhood Center when there was a center in Atlantic. And one of the challenging parts of the volunteers and the paid staff there was to actually make sure they were demonstrating metrics for the planning department. So those metrics were then sent to the federal government. And I mean, we're not able to, was complicated metrics, but they had to make sure that it showed that people were served, who were they, where are they from in terms of geography. They didn't care about them individually, who they were individually. They cared about where they were geographically and what services they needed. So, I mean, obviously, I'm just touching it, but I'm sure if you talk to anyone, Father Bills or QCAP or Social Stars or Quincy Resources or the YMCA or any myriad of local nonprofits to take any kind of grants, whether it be state grants or federal grants, I'm sure they can go more in depth about their accountability requirements.
Well, absolutely. I guess the interesting thing about the Harvard case is they're actually fighting back. They didn't just capitulate. I mean, they have the resources to do that. So I think maybe folks are waiting to see how that pans out.
It would be interesting because I was also surprised that other Ivy Leagues didn't do that too, because not to say this favoritism, but it is not lost on me that a lot of judges come from out of Ivy League schools. A lot of judges come out of Ivy League schools. So in Supreme Court, I believe only one judge, Jackson, my names are terrible, did not go to Ivy League school. Everyone else did.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting for sure.
It will be. Again, I mean, if you don't stand up and fight, then they roll over and die. That's not good either. And of course, it's an enforcement matter, right? At some point, whether or not the Trump administration follows through on final court orders is going to be a question mark. Obviously, they completely sidestepped that poor man from Maryland in the Salvadorian prison right now. Who did nothing wrong, no criminal record, and was picked up in a mistake raid. And I promise you, he would not be the only one. And I promise you, it'll be U.S. citizens also detained and brought up too. Somebody may be wondering why ICE can do this. And it's because they're not law enforcement, they're enforcing civil violations. They're not required to read your Miranda rights. If you're arrested by the police, it's Miranda rights. So these are actually civil enforcement, the civil officers. They're not conventional police. So, this is going to be another interesting challenge in the courts, the extent of civil police powers on civil law enforcement because a violation of immigration visas or being here undocumented is not a criminal act. They use the word criminal, it's not. It's a civil violation. So it's a weird criminal thing. It's not criminal law in the sense that, you ran a red light or you murdered someone. It's not that kind of criminal. It's a civil violation. And so it's no different from, let's say, you violating your license as a cosmetologist regarding practicing outside your license. That is a civil violation. Or you're not complying with health regulations as a funeral director. That is a civil violation. It is not a criminal violation to arise this level. You want to have law enforcement look at it. Look at it. So State Ethics Commission looks at us, that's a civil violation. If they find a criminal act as their investigation was thwarted in, say, ethics, they can bump it up to the AG's office as a potential criminal violation. So there's this kind of like people, misconception. I hope I'm clearing up a little bit here why ICE raids are kind of different because they're not law enforcement in how you and I perceive law enforcement. They're a civil violation. They're actually more akin to a state regulatory agency.
It's kind of okay. All right. It's interesting. Yeah. So it'd be like if the Attorney General's office had their own police force.
Well, I believe Attorney General does have his own police, her own police force, actually.
Well, the state police, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they're actual police. They have to read your Miranda rights.
Right.
You have civil rights protections. This is a civil violation. So, obviously there's a due process component. So if you violate your, let's say, funeral home license because of a health code violation, the health department, you can appeal to the board of registration of funeral directors. And then, if you're unsatisfactory, you could try to appeal again to the courts, but it'd be appealing civil violation. Now, if they, come across the fact that your poor health violation has a direct link to murdering people, that is not the dead body in your funeral home, some other connected incidents, and you had knowledge of doing it, well, that could rise to a criminal matter as part of a civil investigation. And it becomes, okay, we got to send this out to do law enforcement because now this clearly is moved beyond the bounds of a civil violation. So, because I was scratching my head about this too, because there's, you see all kinds of videos out there, news reports, but no one's actually talking about what they are, and it's because the portrayal in the media using terminology as well as political rhetoric, makes it sound like they're a criminal. Sort of, yes, they are a civil violation criminal, not a criminal in the sense that they have committed a crime that requires a Miranda rights.
So yeah, I know you've said this before. Undocumented does not necessarily mean illegal.
Isn't because until it's determined to be illegal by a judge. However, you violate your visa, or you hear about a visa, civil violation, which means they're, you're not a law, law enforcement isn't in charge of that. It's a civil violation. So, It's kind of one of those funky things that no one's really trying to explain because people just makes these assumptions. Because if this was if there was Miranda rights, it would greatly slow down the deportation process because they have to go before a criminal judge, or in this case, immigration judges. In this in instance, there is none.
Yeah, so how do ICE agents have the authority then to arrest people?
What is detainment more arresting? It's a civil violation, so they're really detaining them, right? In terms of non-compliance of the licensing. So generally, you want to have law enforcement somewhere around an ICE as part of it because if it rises to a level of criminal issue, then you can do that. It gets curious, right? I mean, like you and I detained someone unwillingly. It can be conceived as kidnapping. You can see that it's depending on the circumstances, right? This is a very common law school hypothetical they throw at you, right? What is the length of time? What are the conditions? Is there a threat? I mean, what does it take for a civilian person to detain another civilian person? At what stage does it rise to kidnapping? Is it even kidnapping at all? May not even be considered kidnapping, right? This is one of those common law school hypotheticals where any answer could be potentially the correct answer, and it drives law students crazy. Because we'd like to have an answer that we put in an exam that's correct. Yeah, law schools are brutal that way, where they don't always give you the correct answer because the correct answer can be more than one.
No, it's not just black and white all the time.
It's not that simple as a binary answer or yes or no. So, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, ICE for, before it was even ICE, INS, and all its predecessors for 100 plus years, has been deporting people out of this country. It's not new, and they have detained people here, including U.S. citizens, for extended periods. For example, Chinese discrimination on the West Coast is on Angel Island. If you get to California and visit Angel Island in my younger days, you should. U.S. Chinese citizens were detained for months upon months by immigration for no other reason that they were Chinese, and the claim was that they were not U.S. citizens entering the country, despite that they were. And it was a civil violation. They were detained, and there was no criminal act, meaning they couldn't go before a judge for bail. This is kind of one of the little things that the vast majority of Americans don't think about, nor do they have to deal with. That you have this really non-law enforcement, that they're not cops. I don't care. You're law enforcement. You're a cop running around doing civil enforcement, but they have a long history, long before today, of detaining folks on suspicion of their citizenship or their visa status. And the best example I can give you is Angel Island in San Francisco Bay, where the conditions are horrific with detaining Chinese citizens for decades. So we're in Boston area, so we don't see the historical impact of it. And this is kind of lost in our history books and also our geography. This is not part of our history in Boston. And people don't think this has ever happened. No, this has happened. There's a long history of this happening. It's just that we live in a geographic zone. We don't have the same history.
Of course, it brings up the whole question of birthright citizenship too, that's being looked at.
Yeah, like I said before, I mean, if the Chinese lawsuit that set up a birthright citizenship of a Chinese a citizen that had children in the US and they were trying to basically not give the kids of a Chinese citizen citizenship, they're trying to deny them that and then trying to essentially get rid of the kids. Again, untold stories, particularly in the West Coast that we live in the Northeast, don't know anything about. But it was a Chinese lawsuit that determined birthright citizenship. That's also lost in the history books too. People won't talk about that. But I mean, it was designed in the 14th Amendment to address slavery because under Dred Scott, if I remember correctly, slaves were not considered citizens. So they created the concept of birthright citizenship to address slavery. And all free men were now U.S. citizens, regardless of when they were born in the U.S. And this is actually uniquely American. There is no birthright citizenship really anywhere else in the country. I would say anywhere else in the world. Globally, there's always conditions associated with a citizenship status in their home countries.
Right.
So the Trump administration's not looking at U.S. citizens who have kids here. They're looking specifically at undocumented. They're looking specifically at whether undocumented folks here that have kids here can gain birthright citizenship, because the courts have historically read the Constitution here as literal, because there's no ambiguity in the language. You can look up the 14th Amendment. It is pretty straightforward. And the question is whether this court is going to maintain the plain language, or are they going to be looking to do some interpretation, which I don't have an answer for.
Right,
So
yeah.
it's really a very narrow case of undocumented having children here. Whether those children are considered a birthright citizens or not is the real question mark. And one of the what was it? One of my favorite ones of our birthright citizenship is Bruce Lee. His mom was
Martial
visiting, and
arts director.
Bruce Lee is a U.S. citizen because his mom just happened to be visiting San Francisco and whatever reasons, and gave birth to him in the U.S.
I didn't know that.
And then he went back to Hong Kong. So, one of the most famous Chinese actors is actually a U.S. citizen, even though he came, overseas. People kept treating him like, he wasn't a U.S. citizen. He actually is. Which
Interesting.
also kind of interestingly, when there were those surveys, informal surveys came up with famous Chinese, famous Asian actors, Bruce Lee doesn't actually make the list, even though
Oh,
Jackie
wow.
Chan does.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Jackie Chan is not a U.S. citizen. Jackie Chan is not an American actor.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, I did not know that. Very interesting. Now, is that Angel Island you mentioned? Is that was that that's not in existence anymore, is it?
It's a historical site.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You can, you got, if you ever visit San Francisco, I strongly encourage people to take the harbor ship and, hopefully not rough waves. I went many years ago and it was very rough waves. You got to see the seals on the way through. I mean, and you get to an island and then, you spend like, an hour or two walking through cells and the conditions, and you can feel the wind moving through there. And, you can look it up on the internet, obviously,
Yeah.
and read it up by yourself. But these are kind of some of the things that are lost. It's like Japanese internment camps. There's still a few left that are historical sites out there. And if you don't believe the stories, you obviously can visit those sites to see, what conditions these people submitted to between 4 and 6 years.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. I've not heard of that before.
I know it's not AIPI month, but there's a tangential relationship when we talk about immigration and Asian Americans.
We need to wrap up early today, Tacky, unfortunately, because it's school vacation week and I'm busy.
Yeah, I know my voice is just about done. That's
Excellent.
Kenny over here. So no, we're obviously open to State House. Staff is there, 617-722-2370, 617-722-2370. The front desk person has to pick up, they have to go through the prompts, but you eventually get to us. You wait a little while. We're in room 42 of the State House. We'll obviously be there for the budget for at least 3 days. We'll be there running around the place crazy. MALegislature.gov. You'll definitely visit the state website and look up bills and watch our debates. Tacky.chan@mahouse.gov is the email. I'm getting a lot of emails now, as well as State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook and tackychan.org, our resource page. And obviously, you can listen to us here weekly, bi-weekly, as well as listen to Joe's updates first thing in the morning.
And get yourself some antihistamines for allergies, Jackie.
Yeah, absolutely. Dripping away here. All right.
Right. Thanks so much.
Take care, Joe.